afternoon. Also, expect gusty southwest winds. Right now, clouds, a temperature reading of 68. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're looking back 20 years to the events of 9/11 and their aftermath. Of the many morning show interviews which I have recorded over the years that were related in any way to 9/11, I think one of the most compelling was the interview that I was privileged to record with best-selling author and writer William Langvish. What prompted this interview was the publication of an absolutely incredible article in Atlantic Monthly magazine, the first of three articles that were collectively titled American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center. Three articles that were eventually gathered together and published as a book of the same name in 2004. In these articles, William Langvish chronicles the incredible story of the undertaking of clearing away that gigantic mountain of debris that was left in the wake of the collapse of the huge World Trade Towers. It was an undertaking that required relentless energy and courage, innovation, cooperation. And it is a fascinating story that so easily could have been left completely untold. But fortunately, William Langvish was permitted unprecedented access to Ground Zero, and was there to tell the story in breathtaking detail. William Langvish is responsible for a whole series of best-selling books, including Sahara Unveiled, A Journey Across the Desert, Inside the Sky, A Meditation on Flight, and Finding the Devil, Darkness, Light, and the Untold Story of the Chilean Mine Disaster. And again, these three articles for Atlantic Monthly were eventually gathered together and published as a book titled American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center. Ahead of my interview with William Langvish, here is a portion of that first article.
Arriving at the scene over the first few hours, the volunteers joined with the firefighters and the police, who by then were shaking off their disbelief and struggling to take effective action. By afternoon, thousands of people in these combined forces were searching through the ruins for survivors, attacking the debris by hand, forming bucket brigades, and climbing over the smoking pile in that some places rose 50 feet above the street. At 5:20 that day, World Trade Center 7 collapsed tidally in place, damaging some adjacent buildings but killing no one. By dark, the first clattering generators lit the scene, and an all-American outpouring of equipment and supplies began to arrive. The light stuff got there first, soda pop and bottled water, sandwiches, flashlights, bandages, gloves, blankets, respirators, and clothes. Indeed, there were so many donations so soon that the clutter became a problem, hindering the rescue effort. Eventually, a trucking operation was set up just to haul the excess away. People who came to the site in those early days often had the same first sensation of leaving the city and walking into a dream. Many also felt when they saw the extent of the destruction that they had stumbled into a war zone. "It's like something you'd see in the movies," people said. Probably so, but my own reaction was different when I first went in soon after the attacks. After years of traveling through the back corners of the world, I had an unexpected sense, not of the strangeness of this scene, but of its familiarity. wading through the debris on the streets, climbing through the newly torn landscapes, breathing in the mixture of smoke and dust. It was as if I had wandered again into the special havoc that failing societies tend to visit upon themselves. This time, they had visited it upon us. The message seemed to be, here's a sample of our political science. I was impressed by how faithfully the effects had been reproduced on the ground. But you could never confuse New York with a back corner of the world, and the ruins did not actually look like a war zone either. There was a sadness to the sight, to be sure, and anger, but there was none of the emptiness, the ghostly quality of abandonment that lurks in the aftermath of battle. In fact, quite the opposite quality materialized here. Within hours of the collapse, as the rescuers rushed in and resources were marshaled, the disaster was smothered in an exuberant and distinctly American embrace. Despite the apocalyptic nature of the scene, the response was unhesitant and almost childishly optimistic. It was simply understood that you would find survivors, and then that you would find the dead, and that this would help their families to get on with their lives, and that your resources were unlimited, and that you would work night and day to clean up the mess, and that this would allow the world's greatest city to rebuild quickly, and maybe even to make itself into something better than before. From the first hours, these assumptions were never far away. For a few days, the site was out of control. The bucket brigades were ineffectual and barely scratched the surface of the ruins, though not through lack of trying, God knows, but because of the overwhelming weight of the debris. In the end, it probably didn't matter because, as later became apparent, the dead did not die lingering deaths. At the time, however, this was neither known nor knowable. Indeed, very little was. Rumors swept the exhausted crowds of workers and on multiple occasions caused dangerous stampedes away from the imagined reach of One Liberty Plaza, a sound building that was rumored to be falling. People were hurt in those panics. There were too many volunteers and too few heavy machines. But then rather quickly, a crude management structure was agreed upon, and most of the volunteers were eased out to the ruins' periphery to be replaced at the core by a professional labor force that might loosely respond to direction. Firemen and cops on overtime, structural and civil engineers, and up to 3,000 unionized construction workers. And the city government ran the show. Nearly everyone on the site was well paid. The money for the effort came from federal emergency funds and it flowed freely. But despite some serious cases of corruption and greed, money was not the main motivation here, at least not until almost the end. Throughout the winter and into the spring, the workers rarely forgot the original act of aggression or the fact that nearly 3,000 people had died there, including the friends and relatives of some who were toiling in the debris. They were reminded of this constantly, not only by the frequent discovery of human remains and the somber visits from grieving families, but also by the emotional response of America as a whole and the powerful new iconography that was associated with the disaster. These New York firemen as tragic heroes, these skeletal walls, these smoking ruins as America's hallowed ground. Whether correctly or not, the workers believed that an important piece of history was playing out, and they wanted to participate in it, often fervently and past the point of fatigue. From the start, that was the norm. There were some who could not stand the stress, and they had to leave. But among the thousands who stayed, almost all sought greater involvement rather than less. The truth is that people relished the experience. It's obvious that they would never have wished this calamity on themselves or others. But inside the perimeter lines and beyond the public's view, it served for many of them as an unexpected liberation, a national tragedy, of course, but one that was contained, unambiguous, and surprisingly energizing. The site roared 24 hours a day for 8 full months and beyond. From autumn through winter and into the spring, the crews labored on in 12-hour shifts, got some sleep, and came back for more. The enormous scale of their workplace is difficult to convey. Under Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's insistence that New York return quickly to normal, the restricted zone had shrunk by late September to 40 downtown blocks bounded by Chambers, Broadway, Rector, and the Hudson River, which was still a large area to be out of commission. At the heart of it, under the skeletal walls rising to 150 feet above the street, the debris spread across 17 acres in smoldering mounds. It was dangerous ground, of course. Workers at the site called it simply the pile. In detail, the topography was complex, with strange craters and caves, unstable cliffs, and unexpected remnants of the World Trade Center, as it had been before. The torn sculptural sphere on the ruined plaza, the amputated stores with their displays of goods no longer for sale, a row of bicycles still securely chained to a rack, a lamppost here or there still standing. Passers-by peering at the ruins from afar, from beyond the perimeter fences along Broadway or Chambers, were sometimes confused because of their lack of direct involvement. Many expressed amazement that two 110-story buildings could collapse into a mass that was relatively so small. But there was no mystery to the dimensions. Because the Twin Towers had been as much as 90% air and 10% structure, they had contained the equivalent of approximately 11 solid stories of steel and concrete. And beneath these uneven mounds, which stood 5 stories high and spilled into the streets, their remnants filled the foundation hole to bedrock, 6 levels down. The weight alone defied imagination. What does a chaos of 1.5 million tons really mean? What does it even look like? The scene up close was so large that no one quite knew the answer. The most effective machines at Ground Zero were giant diesel excavators, tracked monsters with hydraulic arms and grappler claws that could tear tangles of concrete and steel rods from the surface or close around sections of heavy beams and worry them clear of the pile's embrace one by one. They were voracious, incautious, ignorant, and unstoppable. Soon there were dozens of them in action, painted orange or yellow, working in tandem to daisy-chain the debris out of the trucking operation into the streets, straining and rocking precariously under their loads, with smoke and heavy dust boiling out around them and flames licking their claws. For months, this was how the unbuilding went, like a dance of dinosaurs in a volcanic land of steel, with men there, too, moving through, restlessly searching for their kind. The effects were astonishing. Though the enormousness of the ruins made the final goal of a clean hole seem remote and difficult to imagine, the surface features of the pile changed so fast that time itself was compressed and memories just a week old grew faint. People got caught up in that. Many of the core groups were camped in hotels or temporary apartments nearby. The smart ones reminded themselves that they had recently led ordinary lives and that they would return to them. But weeks felt like months, and months felt like years. And as winter came, it was ordinary life, and not the sight, that began to seem dreamlike and far away. An excerpt from a sprawling article called American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center, by author William Langvish, which is in the current issue, the July-August issue of Atlantic Monthly magazine. Tell me about the experience of first setting eyes on Ground Zero.
When I first went in there, it was on day 4 or 5. The airlines had just started flying. I arrived in New York, went through the perimeter. They talked my way past the National Guard just to take a preliminary look at the site. I wanted to see what the lay of the land was, so to speak. I was expecting something from what people were talking a lot about a war zone and that it looked like war in the movies, and they were so astonished. I know a lot of New Yorkers went in there and felt that they were sort of going through a wall from reality into dream as they went inside. I know that, for instance, people talked about the DMZ zones from Apocalypse Now and similar, somewhat druggy images of hallucinogenic war. I didn't see that at all. I have traveled quite a bit in war zones over the years for my work, and I'm used to a certain emptiness in war zones, a certain sort of almost the quality of a human abandonment that seems to inhabit battlefields, even for those who have won the war. I saw none of that in New York. I was struck mostly by the exuberance of the response. I mean, the energy was just incredible, the smothering, this outpouring of people, equipment, flashing lights, in a way, optimism, energy, competence, this roar of American energy that immediately came in and laid itself across that smoking pile. That's what struck me most. And I thought, this doesn't look like any battlefield I've ever seen.
A word about the size of Ground Zero. One of the interesting paradoxes which you raise in your article is the fact that it was and is an enormous expanse, and yet at the same time you talk about how some people would set eyes at Ground Zero and would be astounded by its compactness in the sense of how huge the towers were,
right,
and yet how they collapsed into a relatively compact area. How could it be both of those things all at once?
Seen from the distance, from outside the perimeter lines, people were peeking in as they should have. I mean, it was they were trying to see this thing, but they were kept away by the perimeter fence and the guards. So they were kept several blocks away. Peeking in from a distance of several blocks away, they could see that they could only catch glimpses, corners of the ruins were in sight, and they could see that it went a certain size, not too high, 5-6 floors, which on the scale of the surrounding buildings is not very high. Don't forget, this is happening in a gargantuan landscape of Lower Manhattan, where the great dinosaur of buildings live. So from a distance, it seemed small. When you got up close, then it was a whole different thing, because you could see a much wider angle. Your view was not restricted by the canyons of city streets. And also, you could put a human scale on it. You could see an individual or several groups of individuals, people moving, climbing across the pile, or if you began to climb it yourself, which I did immediately, to go out into the middle of the pile, you began to realize you realized right away the gargantuan nature of this pile itself. It was very, very big. We can put numbers on it. Numbers mean hardly anything. 1.7 million tons of steel and debris were removed. We know that. What does that mean? Well, it just means a whole lot is what it means. There was a hole in the ground that was 70 feet deep and 10 acres in size. That was the foundation hole for the World Trade Center site. That was full of debris. And then on top of that, it rose another 70, 80 feet. And then, of course, there were the skeletal towers, the skeletal walls that stood there, those vaguely Gothic structures that we all saw many pictures of. It was a very, very large scene of destruction.
A word about the logistics of your work. First of all, you just made mention of the fact that you had to kind of talk your way into Ground Zero that first day when you wanted to see the site. Didn't you say something about sort of sneaking your way past the National Guard?
Right.
And I wonder, what was the mechanism then that allowed you to be there and for you to have the access? I mean, I don't mean who gave you permission, but I mean, did you wear a badge or have some kind of uniform, or in what way were you allowed to be there, or were you constantly having to re-explain your presence?
No. It was clear to me after the first survey that either I was going to get the kind of permission I needed to be there, which was full and complete access, or I was going to leave. And my option was then they were heading me off to probably the northern Afghanistan. This was before the American troops were there. So, It was a stab in the dark. We identified the need for heavy equipment right away with that walk. This did not take brilliance on my part. It was really obvious. The only thing that was going to help find survivors and move that stuff out of there was the heaviest kind of equipment because of the sheer weight of the debris. So I heard there was one man who was bringing in that equipment, in particular, an unexpected man, very much part of the World Trade Center story, all of these unexpected people rising up. This guy was the commissioner of an obscure New York City agency from the outer borough of Queens, and I sent him a fax and said that I wanted him to find a way to get me in there. And it turned out that he was a longtime reader of the Atlantic Monthlies and of mine, therefore, since I write for the Atlantic. And he knew the kind of work we do, and this is also known at City Hall, so he then took it to the mayor's office, and they made one significant exception in the restriction on press, and they gave me full and complete access. It lasted 9 months, and I was there typically 17, 15 hours a day, 7 days a week for the first 6 months. It was a completely unrestricted access also to meetings and to files. So it was a very unusual thing. They had a lot of faith, and they took some risks to let a guy like me in there and to listen to all conversations, to get at all corners of the site at all times of day and night.
What was your battle plan as you headed in for this assignment? I mean, aside from the obvious fact of just being there and seeing and hearing. Otherwise, did you have a sense of what you were going to do going in, or
no,
did you have to wait for events to unfold?
I didn't know enough to have a plan of what to do. But this work, this is what I do for a living, so it's not an unfamiliar situation. I go in sort of rubbing my eyes. I have a strong feeling that I can't see. I don't understand what is happening around me, and this overwhelming urge to try to figure it out. This work requires great arrogance. I mean, it's an extremely arrogant thing to do, in a way, to say, I'm going to go into some place, I'm going to figure it out, and I'm going to express and define reality, in a sense. So I have that arrogance, I guess. I mean, it's a necessary quality for this kind of work. I just went into it and did the job. What I found was completely unexpected, as things often are. I mean, things rarely work out the way you think they will. Otherwise, there probably wouldn't be a need for writers. The cliches fall apart pretty quickly, and then you're left with some pretty new territory, and that's what I found.
One of the things that is mentioned in the USA Today article is that you are not someone who considers themselves an interviewer. What does that distinction mean for you when you say that you hardly ever interview people, you simply talk to them?
I'm not a standard reporter. I don't even know what a standard reporter is exactly, but I'm pretty sure I'm not it. I've never taken a writing class of any kind, let alone a journalism class of any kind. I have no idea how one is supposed to do these things. I suppose I reinvent the wheel all the time. I don't know. But what I do is try to avoid formal settings where, you know, you sit down with some politician with a list of questions. Maybe they've even been submitted in advance, maybe not. Maybe you try to catch the guy, you know, unawares and trick him into saying something he shouldn't say. All of that I don't do. I go into a subject, typically a really deep and complex subject, which is what I tend to write about, and listen to people carefully and talk to them and take minimal notes and rarely use tape recorder and really try to think about what it is that they're saying to me. I try not to impose that formal, you know, I am the reporter, you are the man who's going to, or woman who's going to talk to me, and we have that kind of formal exchange. It becomes a much less formal, less efficient thing, and it turns out to be much deeper that way. This is not the kind of thing you do in a few hours. It takes, in this case, it took me 9 months.
Did you ever have a shovel in your hand or a bucket in your hand? Or, I mean, I know you went into the underground, for instance.
Yeah.
I mean, you were really getting your hands dirty, but
I know what you're getting at. Yeah. There was something unusual here. I did cross fairly early on the border, the boundary between observer and participant. I think it was kind of necessary in a way, and it was necessary because of ethically necessary, the severity of the conditions, the risks that people were taking, the unknown qualities, in the sense that there was very little expertise of any kind that really applied here. Everybody was free-forming it. This was completely unanticipated in the level of chaos, and there were no known solutions. All of that is a way of saying, very early on, I began to, in a minor way, but as a natural way, to participate in many aspects of what was going on there. So I crossed that boundary, and it partly that establishes also a trust between the people I was writing about and me. These people were often taking real risks with their lives, and they saw that I was perfectly willing to do the same.
Right. In the editor's column for this first issue of Atlantic Monthly, they quote you as talking about this undertaking, the cleanup of Ground Zero, is a uniquely American improvisation on an enormous scale. And it sounds like your own work as a reporter on the scene was also, in a sense, improvisatory.
It always is. It always is. That's the nature of the work, of course. I mean, this is very long-form narrative nonfiction. It's not standard reporting. It's always different. Each time is completely different. My subjects vary widely. And this time it was this strange thing, the World Trade Center. Who would have thought? And it requires a lot of improvisation.
We're talking with William Langvish, who is the author of what will be a three-part series for the Atlantic Monthly and eventually a book, American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center. Mr. Langvish, one of the things that I found particularly fascinating about your article is that you take us through the collapses of both of the towers. You say it is important as much as in principle as in practice to make an honest effort to understand the process and mechanisms of each tower's collapse. And clearly you came away with a much more sophisticated, complex understanding of that than most of the rest of us did about what really caused these towers to collapse as they did.
Right. The answer there is that in details, it can be summarized pretty easily. The towers, if they had simply been hit the way they were hit, and they were hit very, very hard, would not have fallen, probably, short of maybe a severe windstorm. That's just possible. But they probably would not have fallen. If they had just burned the way they burned, without having been hit, they would not have fallen. It was definitely a combination of first having been weakened through very severe hits, and then being burned with a severe fire that brought them down. The fire was not the kerosene or jet fuel fire that was presumed. Much of the kerosene, first of all, blew up outside the buildings, ignited, didn't really blow up. It just fireballed out there, and that was actually helpful to the buildings. It was spectacular for the cameras and of no great significance otherwise. The problem is that the rest of the fuel on the inside of the building sprayed simultaneously across multiple floors. That fuel burned through within about 4 to 5 minutes in both cases. It was gone. But what it had done during those 4 to 5 minutes, it had ignited a paper fire, and basically all of the office paper, and our famous, you know, paperless offices and all of that, well, that stuff was burning. And it was essentially some combination of paper and office furniture and similar things, but largely paper that brought those buildings down. That paper fire is a very serious affair. It's estimated that this was equivalent to several nuclear power plants putting out energy. I mean, these were ferocious fires, and of course they would have been uncontrollable by the fire department from below in any case.
The gentleman named Rinaldi, I am not finding his first name at the moment.
Peter Rinaldi.
He's one of the gentlemen that you follow very closely and obviously converse with extensively. One of the really interesting moments in this article is when you actually take us back to 1993 and the terrorist bombing at the World Trade Center, which killed just six people. And, of course, the buildings remained standing. And you say here that the memory of the 1993 bombing turned out to be a trap for many people on September 11th. Explain what you mean by that.
8 years later, another bomb goes off. These airplanes come in and hit those towers. An amazing number of people at the World Trade Center, whether they were people who inhabited the World Trade Center, I mean, whose offices were there, or whether they were the fire department firemen who were responding, had been involved in the 93 bombing and had seen, in fact, the success both of the buildings and the sturdiness of the buildings and of the evacuation and all of that. The conditions in the stairwells in 93 were not good. There was a lot of smoke. The conditions this time in the stairwells were much better. The evacuation was easier this time than in 93. The conditions were more friendly. So there was a feeling both inside and outside the building I think that my sense is that the experience of 93, the success of 93, lay like a mental trap for a lot of people, and helped to strengthen this feeling that the thing would not fall. It hadn't fallen before. Why would it fall now? So certainly the firemen who were climbing those stairwells must have had that in mind. The 93 response had been the largest response in the New York City Fire Department's history previous to the World Trade Center collapse. And it was widely heralded within the department as an example of great success. This is how we should do it, boys. And it was right. I mean, they had done it well. So that was a sort of trap. For Peter Rinaldi, similar thing. He was a Port Authority engineer. He knew both engineering and those buildings extremely well. He was watching this from the outside on television. He happened to be on vacation. He was watching as his office was evacuated and all of that, thinking carefully about the people who worked for him and under him. He remembered the 93 bombing too. He had been trapped for 5 hours in 93 in an elevator and had to cut his way out of the elevator through walls and bad smoke and bad conditions. So he certainly thought, well, he remembered I was there for 5 hours in 93. He thought, well, my staff certainly has plenty of time to get out now.
You do mention in the course of this particular discussion that 15,000, more than 15,000 people walked out safely in stairwells that were well lit and smoke free. We're talking about September 11th, I think.
Right, we are. Yeah. Of course, to generalize grossly here, we know that for the most part, the people who were killed at the World Trade Center were those who were either in the impact zones or above the impact zones and unable to get out.
And you talk about how there is one particular design flaw, if you want to call it that, in the trade towers, which led to some of those deaths. It has to do with the stairwells.
The stairwells were spaced, were not spaced widely apart, but were clustered, so that they now, 2020 hindsight, I certainly don't believe that we should be pointing accusing fingers at the designers on the, about this. But in the future, we might learn if we are to live in a world in which this is a possibility, and I suppose we do live in that world where it's a possibility that somebody will fly an airplane into your building, then it probably is a better idea to space those stairwells as far apart as possible to give people an option for getting out.
One additional question about the actual collapse of the towers. This is something that came as a surprise to me. You say that the death of the South Tower was better understood than that of the North because its symptoms showed particularly well. That was intriguing to me. I'm not sure many of us have taken the time, nor have probably reporters or analysts, to differentiate between the two towers and what happened to each tower.
Right. They failed in different ways. And the symptoms showing well in the South Tower was, for one thing, a very simple thing. By the time the South Tower was hit, the North Tower had been hit, so all the cameras were trained on the World Trade Center. And there was a lot of photographic evidence of the initial impact. There was only one shot of the first airplane going into the North Tower, and it was not very useful. So there was simply a lot of more photographic evidence associated with the South Tower. Aside from that, the South Tower being the second tower to be hit, but the first tower to fall, when it was hit off-center. The United flight that came in punched into it off-center, and so it took out more of one side rather than the center, and was action happening closer to the surface of the building, if you know what I mean, from the inside. Again, this stuff showed better from the outside. All of our evidence of what happened there, almost all the evidence, comes from the outside. There was some evidence from the actual impact zone in the samples of metal, but relatively little was learned that way. And for the simple reason of the off-center geometry of the impact, the evidence was more clear in the South Tower. And as we know, the South Tower then began to topple to the side. The upper part of it did before it then collapsed straight down. So all of that was very clear. It showed the dynamics of the collapse also, in other words, more clearly and more dramatically. The North Tower just sort of seemed to stand there for a long time and then let loose straight down.
We're speaking with William Langvie. She is the author of an article called American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center. Mr. Langvish, something else in which I think you shed very interesting, helpful, fascinating light on a rather obscure facet in this is that you take us underground, the underground world beneath the visible trade towers, and that is where you saw, it seems to me, some of the most interesting sights. Tell us a little bit about that underworld, that underground.
The underground was the ultimate of the Trade Center site. I mean, the Trade Center was a private world there, an amazing private world, a new territory for America in a way. To get to it, you had to go through New York. You had to have the will and effort to exert the effort to get through the perimeter, to get to the site itself, to get to the pile. If you had all of that urge, if you wanted for whatever reason, whether business, whether curiosity, whether altruism, to get to the pile, the chances are you'd want to go farther. And it was sort of the ultimate you could go, the most you could go into that pile, into that scene, was to go from the top of the pile to the bottom of the pile and go to the center. It was not done by many people for obvious reasons. It was risky, and you had to have a reason for doing it. I went on many of those expeditions, and there was a reason for doing it, and that is that the engineers who were doing pretty much the riskiest work at the site were required to go down in there to see what the conditions were. The pile was continuing to collapse for months as it burned, and as the work on the surface continued, the pile was very dynamic, and it was constantly shifting and collapsing. And these collapses and fires and conditions of certain aspects of it had to be charted, had to be mapped. That's what these people did, and I went with them on that. Underground, typically the best way to get through was to go all the way down, because the debris inside the foundation hole, which again is 70 feet deep, that debris formed a sort of inverted mountain, so that it became narrower the farther down you went. For I think it's pretty obvious why that would be. So to get through, often you had to go all the way down to what's known as the B6 level, which was where the bedrock, basically. And you moved then often through water, always through water. Some in the early days, it was by boat in the open passages, inflatable boat. After the water was successfully pumped and it was brought down to about 1 or 2 feet, then you waded through. And now it's very dusty. The view was often very restricted by collapses all around you, the twisted rebar, smoke, dust, crazy tilted steel and concrete, sometimes small streams of molten metal because the fires are burning. And the view was often was kind of spotlighted, because you really typically were moving with 10 people with flashlights. You didn't have a sweeping view. You pick up a site here, a site there, as these beams angled in different directions and swept around. And people moved forward. These expeditions then went forward with specific purposes in mind, taking great risks, actually, sometimes. And this is known as spelunking, often with ropes and in unstable terrain, collapses sometimes happening right around. Rough stuff. But hallucinogenic and quite beautiful often.
It is also the specter of disaster was always looming there in the background, that if this had not been done carefully, there could have been some significant loss of life during that recovery effort.
There were so many ways in which the terrorist attack could have continued to unfold. There were so many ways. I mean, one of the ways it would simply have been, and it remains to be seen, legal action, right? I mean, we don't know to what extent the sort of parasitic impulses of the American system are going to come into play here, and as people start angling for money, we have yet to see what the real extent of that destruction is. But in terms of the physical destruction, there was the possibility of catastrophic flooding, it was an ongoing concern that, of course, there would be mass death on the site with some kind of huge collapse, or most specifically with the release of freon gas. And one of our underground expeditions was an attempt to get into the chiller plant, the enormous chiller plants that lay at the center, at the bottom of the smoking pile, to find out what the conditions were, to see if that freon was in there. We finally did manage to get in there and saw nothing but destruction around us. Extreme destruction underneath the pile in the chiller plant area, which was a good sign. It meant that those chiller plants, that the tanks must have been ruptured, and were not now going to be releasing that gas to threaten the hundreds or thousands of workers who were on the pile at the time.
I want to ask you just a bit about the encounters you had with those who were working so tirelessly above ground in this recovering, unbuilding effort. By and large, as you talked to the workers there, what did you find? What kind of stories were told, or what kind of images did you see in their eyes or hear in their voices?
Nobody at that site ever forgot that many people had died there, or that this had been an attack on the United States, or that the place was loaded with symbolic meaning. That was always present in people's minds. So there was a sense of the terrible waste of the entire scene. I mean, that this had been a waste of people and material in America. But at the same time, the real emotion there, and from very early on, was one of energy, optimism, creativity, and enjoyment is the wrong word, but sort of the time of people's lives. I mean, people were doing something that they had never imagined that they would do before. And it, as the site closed, as it came to a close after 9 months, the last few months, there was a depression, because many people realized they would never do anything like this again. They were participating in something which they felt was extraordinary, and which extraordinary in many ways, not just because of the symbolic meaning, not just because of the results, but also because internally, inside that inner world, there was a new form of democracy at play. There was the standard bureaucratic restrictions had fallen away. Standards of safety had fallen away. People were redefining themselves as individuals and as groups all the time. There was an enormous amount of improvisation that was necessary because of the extent and severity of the chaos, so that you really couldn't plan. And all of the standards of normal life, many of the standards, simply dropped away. People were living in a separate world there. They were as far away from New York City as you could be. And people out in Manhattan really had no idea what was going on inside there. There was the public, image of grieving, which was politically necessary. But it really, on the inside of the World Trade Center site, there wasn't a lot of time spent grieving. People were involved in practical response.
There was too much work to do.
There was a lot of work to do. That's right. And it was urgent, because in the beginning, in the early days, it was assumed that there would be many survivors. And and every minute counted. It was easy to imagine people trapped in cavities in that still very unexplored underground, who were waiting, and maybe with water, and maybe even with food, who were waiting to be released.
Here is one more excerpt from this article in the Atlantic Monthly called American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center by William Langvish, before we hear a closing comment from him. Most people at the site understood that the loss that firemen felt was real. One morning in October, I accompanied Ken Holden into the expanding valley at the center of the pile, where a temporary access road of ground asphalt millings was being built. A fire chief came up and said, "You got to give us time. You got to get these guys to stop covering up the debris, burying us with dirt." Before Holden could answer, another fireman, an older man in filthy clothes and a scarred helmet, rushed up and said, "You stop these guys from pushing dirt in here." He had a weathered face and heavy sweat on his upper lip. His eyes were wild. He said, "I've got two friends out there, and I've got my son buried right in here." Holden put a calming hand on his shoulder, but to no effect. The fireman wandered off with his shovel, a short, entrenching tool bent 90 degrees, and climbed down into a hole in the rubble. The chief repeated almost apologetically, "He lost his son in there." Holden said, "How much time do you need? A day? 2 days?" The chief swept his hand wide. "They're buried all through." Holden went off to find Burton and tell him to stop the road for now. When he came back, the old fireman was down on his knees, probing loose debris and sniffing shovelfuls for the scent of death. For most of the men on the pile, the loss was less acute. Even if these were fellow firemen who had died, and even if they were close friends, and even if people used the word brother to describe them, it was not the same as losing a son. Still, over the first few months, there was a lot of sadness at the site. Away from the photographers and TV cameras, the depth of it was not always obvious. The fire department search parties operated on a regularized schedule in small groups beside the diesel excavators, and they sifted through the fresh debris with workmanlike efficiency. But they also took risks for no obvious reason, jumping suddenly into newly opened debris holes, climbing on the unstable cliffs, and especially standing for hours in the heaviest smoke and dust, refusing as a matter of pride to wear the respirators that dangled around their necks. They seem to have surrendered to an attitude of reckless self-abandonment. To varying degrees, the police and construction workers had surrendered to it, too. In one of the Salvation Army feeding tents, I talked to a psychologist who blamed the risk-taking on survival guilt, which he called a common reaction to disaster. To me, however, it looked like a simpler form of grief. But the risk-taking was also the expression of a more creative and courageous impulse linked to the need for action and improvisation, and part of the personal freedom that was unexpectedly emerging at the Trade Center site. It was a response as well to the sheer magnitude of this calamity, the hijackings, the killings, the collapses, events so extreme that they required extreme actions in return. Despite all the divisions at the site, this was the fundamental understanding that people shared, and indeed that the culture at the site demanded. And then, of course, there was the pile, always the pile. It had been the focus of ferocious energy during the collapse, and now again was the focus during the unbuilding. The pile was an extreme in itself. It was not just the ruins of seven big buildings, but a terrain of tangled steel on an unimaginable scale, with mountainous slopes breathing smoke and flame, roamed by diesel dinosaurs and filled with the human dead. The pile heaved and groaned and constantly changed and was capable at any moment of killing again. People did not merely work to clear it out, but went there day and night to fling themselves against it. The pile was the enemy, the objective, the obsession, the hard-won ground. Very briefly, can you tell us what is ahead in these next two installments of this story? First, something called The Rush to Recover, and then something called The Dance of the Dinosaurs.
The first installment that's now in the newsstands is sort of the survey part, with a strong emphasis on the engineering underground, the ultimate of the Trade Center site. The second part, The Rush to Recover, is about, which will appear in the September issue of The Atlantic, is it's about the urgency of the first few months, especially the search to find the living and then the search to find the dead. How it is exactly that this thing actually unfolded in the beginning off the organization charts, the creativity involved, that's the rush to recover. The third part, The Dance of the Dinosaurs, is about the actual process of removing all this steel from the world's, you know, richest city and getting it away and finding the bodies and doing this very complicated mining operation, which was basically a mining operation in which bodies were involved all throughout, and in which was happening in a symbolically and politically loaded way. So it wasn't just your standard, you know, mine. It was a very difficult operation to pull off. And the Dance of the Dinosaurs, the third part, is about that. All of these are largely about the human story. There's relatively little about the physical process. I do that as quickly as I can. But I found that the really interesting thing here was sort of the blank slate of America as we are today that was exhibited at the World Trade Center site.
Right. I am so grateful to Atlantic Monthly, as I'm sure you are too, that they have yielded so much space and time so this story can be told in such thorough, riveting detail. And I thank you so much for your time today in talking with us about this article.
Well, thank you very much.
William Langvish, responsible for this article called American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center, the first of three installments to appear in the Atlantic Monthly. This first article is on the current issue, July-August.
I've recorded this interview with William Langvish just after the publication of this first of the three articles called American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center. These three articles were eventually gathered together and published as a book of the same name in 2004. William Langvish currently is an international editor for Vanity Fair magazine and writer-at-large for the New York Times magazine. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I speak with Reed Forgrave, author of a really exceptionally interesting and touching book called Love, Zach, Small Town Football and the Life and Death of an American Boy. It tells the story of a young man named Zach Easter, who loved the game of football, as did his whole family, and played football in high school in a ferociously competitive way, but suffered recurrent concussions, which ultimately led to the development of CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Ultimately, Zach Easter took his own life, but wanted people to know his story and wanted some good to come out of his tragedy, as does his family. This book is the remarkable story of Zach Easter and his family. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Wednesday, I hope to be speaking with a Carthage grad, Adam Larson, who now works for the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad State Park in Church Creek, Maryland. September happens to be Underground Railroad Month, so we will find out more about this important facet of our country's history. On Thursday, Dr. Jim Ripley from Carthage College, from the music faculty, talking about the first band concert of the season, and we'll also be talking with him about his work as a member of Carthage's COVID Coordination Committee, finding out how the school is continuing to contend with COVID. And on Friday, a look at John Wilkes'